all interested persons at a coffee hour Monday afternoon at 3, room 256 of the Student Union. Because he's here for only one day, he will not be meeting with classes, so this is the only opportunity that people will have to come and talk with him. We'd like to get the first issue of the newsletter turned in to the printers next week. So if you haven't given me your good news for the newsletter, please do so and give it to me on a scrap of paper after the reading tonight if you like, or give us a call. We especially like news of publications, honors, and awards. And you know we only print good news. We don't want to hear about your rejections. I hope you can stay after the reading tonight to meet Marcia Southwick. We'll have the punch and cookies set up in the breezeway between the two sections of the building, since they don't want us in the Student Union. Marcia Southwick is currently teaching at the writing workshop at the University of Iowa. She's also taught at Stevens College in Columbia, Missouri. She, with her husband Larry Levis, founded and co-edits the Missouri Review. She's recently co-edited an anthology of women writers, which will be published soon by Macmillan. Her most recent book is The Night Won't Save Anyone, from the University of Georgia Press. It's a great privilege to introduce Marcia Southwick.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I think tonight what I'll do is I'll read from the second half of The Night Won't Save Anyone, and then I'll read newer poems, because I'm more interested in what I'm doing now than I am what I was doing a few years back. But just to explain to you a little bit about what I'm trying to do now and was, I think, in the second half of the book, not so much in the first half of the book, I'm very interested in a kind of philosophical argument that uses the image rather than statement in it. The first four poems I'd like to read are about the Connecticut River, where I spent a lot of time as an adolescent, where the river meets the Sound. And the first of these is called Upon Hearing of a Drowning in the Connecticut River. And it's addressed to the drowned man. That you once lived here means nothing to the edge of the lawn, nor to the shrubs grown wild beyond your dying. The marsh goes on surrounding the fishing boats, and the boats keep drifting away past your terrible smile. Leaves are lost, or they are scattered like the shadows around your address. Your language has come and gone like a knock at the door. So the time has come for the floorboards to be still and for the windows to let your breath go out into the rain, because you are walking somewhere else now. And between here and wherever you are, there is only this river freezing over, the water gradually hardening into obsidian, the stone bridge sprouting shadows like weeds. In the neighboring field, two brown and white spotted horses lean toward each other, the thin smoke of their breath rising in the cold. There is only this winter. You fell into it suddenly, and now you are like the swallow, those delicate bleached bones beneath the elm tree. Now you are like the fox, that tattered fur and black blood on snow. One thing about landscape, and about this particular landscape I'm writing about, is that it has somehow the capacity to make you feel as if you're being witnessed by it, as well as, you know, the reverse. And I think that enters my poems a lot, that feeling. This one is called The Marsh, and it's about returning to the landscape after having been gone for a while. the marsh, and that feeling of being left out of the landscape. Each time I return to this place, I expect to find a recurring distance between myself and the huge trees, as though I were in a dream in which I could run toward them forever and never get there. Right now, the marsh seems unfamiliar because the crickets have taken me by surprise. Their singing has entered my mind just now, even though I've been hearing them all along. So I'm almost afraid, because there must be other ways in which I am left out of the landscape. It's as if the mallards stay hidden in the grass for a purpose. But I don't think they are there to make me understand what I don't already know, only to point out how often I'm surprised. And that is why the mallards fly suddenly upward, leaving the grass empty and essential. And when I try to summarize the difference between the tide and the way I remember it, I find myself unable to explain, all that I have discarded, the driftwood, fish skeletons, and chipped shells are remnants of a past life I can't possibly understand. Here, you can come in and sit down if you want. Sorry. This next poem is Winter Gulls. At first I narrow my eyes because I think that maybe the gulls want more from me than simply my observation of them. But then I realize I'm mistaken. It's just that they are usually thought of as beautiful, while to me they look like scraps of dirty cloth as they flap about over a dead fish left on the dock. On another day, I might have exercised them more easily from my mind, or I might have walked out to the wet rocks and thought again of all the years the rocks and the tide have stayed unmoved by each other. But today, it's as if the grass doesn't want to be disturbed by anyone walking too quickly. So I stay in one place and keep staring at the gulls reeling over the fish. And I think of myself as elsewhere, how around me there are always other people. And to them I am always there, but never here. And it seems to me that this is a terrible tragedy, like losing a best friend, though everyone keeps talking nevertheless, or calling to each other over what they think is the not too serious distance between them. But sometimes, like now, I can feel that distance becoming acute. It's as if I were asleep and trying to open my mouth. This next poem is based on a story my mother told me. An acquaintance of hers thought that the marshland was so beautiful that she decided she wanted to cast her husband's ashes out over the land. And my mother said, all right, but she was secretly angry about it because she didn't really like the woman, and it meant that the woman would keep visiting her. And she actually admitted to me that she was angry. So I said, I've got to write a poem about this. Now, of course, my mother's angry at me for having written the poem. And it all accelerates like that. That's the way relationships between children and parents are. It's called Owning a Dead Man. She really does own a dead man, though. The geese fly off, but sometimes they don't take their voices with them. Stretched out like this, I think my future is simple, like a cornfield filling with light. I'm happy because of the way the geese have left their shadows drying on the lawn around me, and the way the long docks lean out into the water, letting the unpainted boats knock against them. Once, my mother told me, A woman came to this place with an urn that held her dead husband's ashes. The woman's pale hands tossed bits of gray-white bone and soot onto the marsh where the quail hid. My mother was angry that the bones had trespassed her land. In a way, she said, I own a dead man. Now as I lie here, I think of the coming winter, of his bones mixed with the bones of the mouse and the gull, cleansed and shining in the new snow. But if I try to think too deeply, it's as if a bird were pulling straws from a dried-out nest. So I wonder if I have ever witnessed the middle of winter, the birch tree's inability to lose anything more, or if I've ever seen myself as more irrelevant than in December. In that cold and stillness, my blood and my muscles contracting as I tramped through the snow couldn't possibly mean anything. And there are days when a landscape feels nothing for its real trees, only for what lies still in the snow, or only for what has been. The next group of poems are landscapes also. It's an obsession, I think. But these don't have a specific landscape as the others did. And the first of these is a small incident that happened to me when I was 5 and to my brother. And it's called A Burial Green. It was afternoon, and my brother split a turtle's head open in the rain. The tiny skull glistened, and soon the ants knew every detail of cracked shell. For hours he sat in the blue shade of the elm, planning a burial for his small dead, until the shadows knew each curve of grass around the green and orange spotted shell, a tiny helmet filling with air. It was spring, and the bark on the dogwood trees was slick and wet. The cardinals twittered on the green feeder. And my brother thought it was ceremony, the way the door to our white house opened, and he entered, done with his spade and boots. The way my mother hovered in the doorway and touched his shoulder without a word, like the rain. A friend of mine once told me, and I hadn't known this beforehand, that birds fly low before rain. And what impressed me about that statement was that landscape had the power, or things in landscape had the power to be ominous or to have omens to them. So in this poem, I contain that idea, and I wanted to get the ominous feeling of the landscape in also. And it's called Landscape. The grass is not yet drained of color, and the birds are flying low as before rain. The landscape has the look of something looked at too long, a vanity by which things know themselves, as a mirror knows. In August, you have found the day full grown as a crop you are afraid to harvest. You are the raven afraid of the ash tree, or the snake which tries to coil itself around a stream of water. Though it tries and tries, the air is still as futile, just as gray. Can you think of another landscape like this one, of a pond as black and obscure? The faces in the water float easily as leaves, or now they are blown about like bits of burnt paper. This is the only landscape you know, the wind obligated to fill the curtain by your window, and the ashes on the sill knowing vaguely what they were. Another friend told me another piece of information. I have more than one friend, which, you know, now you know that. Told me that field mice sleep in winter under the snow. And somehow, being a poet, I took that extremely literally and worried, you know, every time I walked out on the snow that I was going to crush a field mouse. So I thought that the least I could do was write a poem about it. But the poem transformed itself immediately into a poem about God. And I don't really know how these things work. But so it begins with mice and moves to God. And it's called Dusk. I cannot worry about what lies beneath the surface. So I walk into the fragile dusk, breaking the backs of field mice, still asleep under the snow. The sunlight that does not reach me illuminates the distance between this world and God's, where winter is simply the white of perfect concentration. I would like to believe in God, just as I would like to believe there is an angel weeping beneath the Chinese elms. But he is an abstraction, like forgetfulness or mathematics. In the mind of God, winter can be paraphrased as one dark tree. And yet, as I walk out over the frozen pond, the pure white of this winter enters my mind, and I become more open. Like a clearing in the woods where light accentuates the dead underbrush without emphasizing its ugliness. And so I can live with my faults. I can be touched and not feel like a passing shadow. In the next poem, another landscape poem, I'm trying to use the landscape to convey a particular state of mind where it's a feeling of vulnerability, as if your nerves have been exposed. And the poem is addressed to, or for my mother, and to my mother. But it's also to me. I didn't realize that till later, that the poem is also to me and about a connection between my mother and I. And it's called Beneath the Beech Trees. In winter, you began to forget yourself, and little by little, you grew confident until you were no longer afraid of the future, which, like a wheat field in snow, seemed a place of exile. And every morning seemed new to you, like the first day of marriage, and you spent those days quietly, wrapped in the invisible chrysalis of yourself. But then one day you began singing, and the voice was sad as a prisoner's. As we walked through the winter garden, you pointed out that according to summer, we are extinct, and that each season is unable to acknowledge any other because they exist back to back. But soon you became quiet upon hearing the cries of the grackles, as though you thought they'd flown here from another world. Or maybe you thought they had traveled the distance between you and the landscape. It didn't matter whether the grackles were meaningless or full of meaning. They weren't even a point of reference. Nor does it matter now how lost you look beneath the beech trees, though to you the trees may seem prophetic because they live much longer than you do and have a more direct connection to the future. Yet here they are, and here you are, and you're holding your own. This next poem began with an epigraph from Margaret, a poem by Margaret Atwood, and the epigraph is, "I am a word in a foreign language." And the poem is called "Poem in Which I Am an Old Woman." I am a word in a foreign language, but I don't know what the word is. So I sit here quietly, an alien to my name. Around me, the hedges rustle. Finches settle on the roof, unaware that nothing has changed, that the field has been plowed again, holding the seeds inside it like a secret. And if there were a secret to be told, it would be my name in another language, uttered like a prayer for rain. The rain that is falling beyond me in another country, the clouds drifting toward another year. Now the finches scatter all at once. There is a connection between myself and their cries. If bird cries or shadows or too many barns on a hillside are confusion, then maybe I should continue to live in confusion. But now it's as if the dusk doesn't have meaning anymore, which makes me want to turn inward like a rose turning to ashes, or become next to nothing like the thin reeds. Instead, I'm more like the brown snake, its color so obvious that it seems to rub off a fine powder onto the white stones, until nothing of me is hidden, no part of me is crouched in the long grass. And yet I can't see everything. I can't know how exalted the owl feels as it becomes what it is by navigating the air, by closing in on the mouse. Though like the mouse I have learned, I am not acceptable to everything. I'm not acceptable to the grass, which in this wind seems to lean away from me and somehow closer to the end of my life. The last poem is in the book is The Night Won't Save Anyone, the title poem. I'm trying to think of a way to explain it. And the easiest way, I suppose, is to describe the sensation I had while writing it. I kept trying to put myself into a winter scene in the poem. And each time I did that, I was also aware that I wasn't in a winter scene, that I was in a warm kitchen in Missouri writing a poem. And for some reason in this poem, it seemed artificial not to recognize that. And so somehow the poem, I think, works on these two levels of myself inside the scene and also myself outside of it writing the poem and a view of both somehow. The night won't save anyone. Someday our bodies will no longer matter and we will leave them in our sleep to travel easily. But until then, I will tramp like this through the woods and not worry that the snow falls gently between us. What separates people happens by accident, like unexpected weather, and it is also caused by the fact that there's always another handshake to be done without, always another unnecessary embrace. It's the way there are those extra pear trees over there, next to those extra houses, which one day will be abandoned. In one of them, a man and a woman are kissing. Sun is pouring in through the windows, and behind them, a gold paper fan is spread out on the mantelpiece. Now I realize they are my parents, and everything seems suddenly empty. Or maybe I'm afraid of losing what never happens by having it happen. I turn away. It has grown darker. The crows are where they aren't supposed to be, on the scarecrow. The horses have already forgotten what daylight is. The swallows are leaving. A dried nest falls from the barn. The smell of damp hay, steam rising from manure. The boy ringing a bell doesn't care if I listen. He doesn't mind if I come up to the house or sleep each night on a torn sack in the barn. I admire his indifference. But how quickly the sun sets on this page. The night has a certain, how shall I say it, style. It is not concise and reminds me of my own poems. And the night won't save anyone. It has another life as I do, outside the poem. And in that life, there isn't any landscape, just the mind doing its work. The mind which always wants to cling to such things as dear, trotting through rain, while at the same time wanting to be rid of them. It's the way I try to visualize my childhood friends, and they grow smaller as if I am walking away from them. Their faces begin to dissolve in a spiral. I should have left them alone. This has happened before. Sometimes, while I am sitting in my room reading, my mind will pass through the book, the way water passes through a grid and eventually finds itself joining a river which silently passes from town to town by the factories and stockyards. I turn the page. The shade deepens on the lawn. I can remember the way I felt as a child when I would go out into the woods and think of myself as invisible. I was convinced I could become part of the foliage. Now I often feel the reverse, as though I stand out in a landscape, a scarecrow in a burned field. This makes me wonder if most people think that winter is like an equation to which they are being added, or maybe to them the sky is just so much whiteness. If so, they're better off, because they don't have to spend their time wanting to be the perfect silence after a long rain. Nor do they have to worry about feeling overlooked by the birch trees. Instead, they can look into themselves. But when I look into myself, I feel as though I am looking into a pond in which the water is hiding something. The bones from last year's drowning, the split jaw, the cracked skull. I must go on admiring myself, though it's the same as admiring a sunset, which is to be feared because of its nakedness. And I go on believing that these words are real, that they want to signify more than the rainy sky or the early October evening. But as I say each one, it looks for something concrete, the way grief goes looking for a dead loved one, or the way a wind scavenges through yellow leaves, looking for the visible part of itself. Thank you. Now I'll move on to some newer poems. A lot of times when I'm writing, I'll write in the present tense. And what happens when I'm writing the kind of meditative poem I do is that almost any feeling I happen to have at that moment can enter the poem at will. And it's hard to control that because sometimes you're feeling different things. But in this particular poem, doubt, the feeling of doubt, maybe about writing the poem, I think the act of writing, the physical sensations of writing have a lot to do with what enters the poem. And anyway, doubt is the feeling that enters this poem. It's a kind of purified emotion, though, because I don't describe what causes the doubt. You know, it's not attached to a real scene. But then I always feel things that I don't know what the causes are, so small difficulties. Is there any difference between what I am thinking and the falling snow? The snow is covering what I will soon forget. The dry wheat fields, the pale leaves scattered everywhere like small mistakes, and the red house on the hill where the neighbors sleep too soundly, like lovers who haven't yet considered each other's faults. To the snow, my footprints are small difficulties to be taken care of later. My breath and the cold air are a contradiction of terms. And these words are like bird cries that clutter the air for a moment, then die. If it's true that I exist in the shadow of my doubts that have appeared like bad weather out of nowhere, then this would explain why I feel like timber about to be cut down. It would explain why there is something not quite right about the ice on the pond, which seems to give off a feeling of good intentions, even though it is dangerously thin. And it would explain why the light of the moon outwits me when it fails to enter my bedroom window on the nights I wake from sleep and need to know exactly where I am. It would also explain why tomorrow, as it comes closer, seems to have the look of already having been lived in. And yet, the sun still bothers to rise and set over the dark barns and fields of disinterested cattle, and the wind still bothers to touch the abandoned silos, as if to reassure them that they are still there. So perhaps it's true that not all is lost. The snow as it falls is repeating itself. Over and over, it repeats what it is. The body. In my future, there are ashes that control me. And yet I go on troubling the grass with my footsteps. I am reminded that this is a place, and that my body will never learn to speak the pale language of the sun. I am reminded that the light of each day will not pass through my personal history to clarify the events that have changed me. The night is obligatory, and there's no point in trying to investigate its origin in order to alter the state of things. Outside, the blackbirds will always peck at the seeds on the tough brown lawns, or disappear without worry into the sky, which makes me think that the sky must be pure as a future without sins. And that one day I would like to go there too, and be clear and shapeless without belongings. Because I've had enough of my body that surrounds me with its blood, hair, and teeth. I've had enough of this autumn, which is destined to fail, as if the leaves contain within them the instructions for falling, or as if they will whirl into next month, unamazed at the new season. If it weren't for me, the coming night would be a chemistry of perfect shadows. And as I walk into the open field, I feel that the shy grass doesn't understand what it is like to be of solid weight and mass, to take up space and to shiver in the cold. I usually don't begin a poem with the title in mind at first, but this one I did, and the title is Solo. And it reminded me of three things: soul as in spirit, soul as in sun, and solo as in singing or traveling alone. Luckily, I didn't think of the sole of one's shoe or fillet of sole, because that would have been a disaster. I thought of those later. Anyway, I think I was trying to keep those three meanings of the word into the poem. Subconsciously, though, I didn't really understand what I was doing till later. Solo. There are times that falter, like flowers in front of me, and times that take root in my chest, like a change of heart. Certain kinds of foliage respond to me. Ferns, for example, are onlookers. There are also flowers that have died, only to be born again, like old opinions. Perhaps it's true that my body won't always travel solo away from the place of my birth. I have come a long way through the serious underbrush, and will probably come to a clearing soon. I can't help thinking, though, of all the shadows I've left behind and that were once very important to me. It would be useless to look for them now, the way it would be useless to keep track of my footsteps lost in the grass. And though I would like to be grass, which doesn't defend itself, but simply waits to become undeniably green, I know that there's nothing left to negotiate. The old roads that used to lead somewhere are now overgrown with weeds, and the sun aches to occupy everything. After writing a lot of these meditative poems, it occurred to me that I should, as antidote in a way, write something autobiographical. And so this next poem is an attempt to do that. It combines various scenes in my life together into one poem. Also, the other thing I was doing in the other poems is writing in a very long sentence. And as an antidote to that, I tried a fragment, no sentences. The only thing, it's called Doors Opening Here and There. The only thing you need to know about it is that my father, who is a surgeon, is also a sculptor and has been trying to move from one career to the other, and that's created some family turmoil. Doors opening here and there. A broken rain spout. The dream about water rising up the stairs. Mother and I trapped in a small rectangular room. Her bones turning to plaster when I touch them. A melon rotting on the kitchen sill. Doors opening here and there into rooms where no one is permitted. Mother pushing father away without the use of physical force. She looks at him as if from a great height, the way one would look at stones on the ground from the point of view of a roof. All of this occurring over cups of coffee. A few clouds scattered like minor complaints. Mother's description of my brother's apartment, no chairs, cardboard nailed over the windows, and a wife who cries when he returns from work and watches TV without speaking. Her possible description of me, how one morning my son carried handfuls of ashes out of the dead fire and rubbed them into my hair as I slept, stretched out, drunk, on the white couch. Open windows, the wind disturbing the stillness of the lamps and portraits. The feeling of being lost among familiar objects, of being unrecognized by the striped wallpaper and dried flowers. My husband, in a closed room listening to Pachelbel, in tears because his father, now dying, used to close himself in a room and listen to Pachelbel. A crack in the wall that never shows itself. My husband's father asleep in a chair in the blue living room in California, the wrong words that used to seize him. How will you get there, the four-lane hospital? The calm white of the almond trees. The rain speaking in extinct syllables. Connecticut, what mother said to father about his change of career. I married a doctor, not a sculptor. Father was measuring the distance between my hairline and my chin for the bust. What father said to me on a ferry from Maine to Canada. Your mother's friends play golf. I hate golf. Noticed the apparent closeness of a couple walking down the rainy street just beyond the neatly trimmed hedges. Then realized the rain was responsible. Not their emotions, but the rain causing them to huddle together beneath the umbrella. No comfort in knowing the trees have flowered according to my belief that they would. A few blackbirds jarring the ear with insults. The next two poems I'll read are about a particular problem related to memory. And that is, how do you ever really know the particular facts behind what you remember, whether they're true or not true? Because anytime you have emotional attachment to a memory, it has the tendency to alter or change the facts. The first poem the emotional attachment to the facts may have obscured them altogether. And it's a poem called The Liar. Years ago, I hid beneath the porch of our white farmhouse, hoping that someone would notice my absence. For hours, I tolerated the ants crawling over my legs because I wanted to hear my parents call out my name in worried voices. Nothing happened. My mother and father sat on the porch above me and talked about setting traps for the mice that invaded the house each spring. Once, I painted a black half moon beneath my eye. At school, I told a story that changed as the day wore on. I'd fallen from a tree. I'd been chased by my brother with a stick. I had been slapped in the eye by my mother. Soon the black eye seemed so real to me, I didn't notice the black paint beginning to smudge across my cheek. Of course no one believed me, but the stories were true, and the paint was simply an excuse to tell them. My mother had migraine headaches and used to slap our heads to ease the pain. Sometimes she chased us through the house with a pair of scissors in her hand. Later, when my eyes went bad, I was relieved because I thought the doctors would finally discover my concussions. But Mother wouldn't let them test me. She didn't want anyone to know. Now my mother claims not to remember any of this. Either my mother is a mad woman, or I am mad, and this story is a lie. Maybe it doesn't matter. It only matters that something irrevocable happened, causing me to say all of this. And here's another one about the same kind of problem, but it's more of an abstract poem. It's called Why the Rain is Ignored. The rain on the roof doesn't understand how complicated our memories are, how we can choose to remember a hot day in Moscow and the faces of two peasants quarreling over a horse, but not the room of a hotel we spent an entire winter in, nervous or drunk. Maybe we don't want to remember the day we saw two lovers quarreling. It was November, and the elm trees around them seemed unaware of the words flung like black coins into the snow. So we concentrate only on the flaw in the thin layer of ice on the pond behind them and try to forget that one of them hurried out over the surface as the ice creaked with the sound of a pine tree about to fall. Once I stood in a spring fog after hearing the news of a friend's disappearance. I can't recall exactly how I felt, but the jonquils on the lawn seemed uncomplicated as they tipped their heads in the sluggish gray air, and a few pink blossoms fell easily from the magnolias, as if the trees were unafraid of their own nakedness. Maybe we are part of a long story to be told by someone who will purposefully misinterpret what has happened, so we shouldn't worry about the details of our lives. It won't matter, finally, if we die in a yellow field, feeling the distance grow between ourselves and the flowers, or in an empty street beneath the neon sign of a bar, in the silence just before someone touches the ivory keys of a piano. When we die, we do not reach conclusion. In the minds of others, the memories of us will be altered, or we will be ignored, like rain falling through the open windows of a house where no one lives. Here's another little cheerful poem. It's called Boarded Windows, and it began when I was living in Iowa City and had mice in my house and was also feeling kind of claustrophobic in this house. So it kind of constellates around that emotion. And it's called Boarded Windows. Will I die while thinking of dull gray houses in the rain, attics where moths eat our clothes, closets where mice sleep, drawers that won't open, doors that have lost their knobs, newspapers piled in the cellar, or faded yellow wallpaper? Will I die while thinking of apples rotting on the kitchen table, white sheets on the line, dull knives, rattling pans, rugs asleep in the hall, shoes thrown in the corner, or red curtains pulled shut? I don't want to die in the silence of floorboards waiting for footsteps, old coats waiting to be worn, mirrors waiting for eyes to look at them, windows waiting for hands to close them, or flowers on a table waiting for water. I don't want to die because death reminds me of an abandoned secret wanting to be told. The secret is nothing can alter the sequence of events that have led me to make certain wrong decisions. The secret is my wrong decisions will crowd around me in the end, like apologetic children trying to convince me of their good points. The secret is my past will seem suddenly less habitable, like a quiet house with boarded windows. And so I will refuse to think. I will simply be aware of the rain falling into the empty street when I feel my body being pulled as if by gravity toward the end of things. And then I think I'll end with two very new poems. In fact, they may not quite be finished, but that's okay. I learn a lot about them from reading. You know, I'll learn something by reading them. At a class in Iowa, I was talking to a student, and I said, what would you most like to write about right now? And she said, God. And I thought, you know, that's thinking awfully big. Do you think you can really write a poem about it? And I was trying to argue her out of it. Well, of course, that night, I went home and wrote a poem addressed to God, and it's called Prayer. It isn't up to something simple, dust or It isn't up to something simple, dust or poison, to decide the plans for us. We are trying to fathom the desert white calendar you live by, and the white leaves outside the mind in heaven that do not tell time. We're trying to solve the riddle of our own yawns, though we continue to yawn and call to you. We tap our secular forks on the table. We tap our feet on the wood floor. This is a very poor prayer, as if spoken by the exact moment, 7:30. For you, there is no change, no wind on your face and hands, the wind that finds us here, caught in our bodies and hoping that it's worth it. And what is lost, the connection between you and the dead branches outside the window that cross and recross in the wind, between you and the tiny statue of lovers covered with ice in the yard, between you and the bird cries, which also seem to have nothing to do with the placid light of the moon. All of this must mean something, even if the meaning is being recorded somewhere in secret, among the white pages of your personal winter. If you intend for us here on earth not to be any closer to each other than the squat hills outside of town that roll in opposite directions toward the bland flat plains, then believing in you is unnecessary. Like believing that the snow could cover our ill feelings, as if our ill feelings were a broken down hut, a last holdout, or believing that the rain could be a solution, that it could somehow extinguish our anger a small brush fire beginning to sputter and blaze in the backwoods. Yet even if we are no more important to you than roses thrown into an obscure fire that shrivel and turn to ashes more quickly than we can say our lives have gone up in smoke, even if nothing changes and we never know why the rain taps its undecipherable code on the rooftops or why the patches of sunlight fall at random on the wrong places on condemned factory walls, on the floors of abandoned schools, on the unimportant back roads. And even if the hours continue to crowd around us like too many gray identical houses, we will try to talk to you. We will talk to you from where we live, here, between survival and surrender. And then the last poem is called Blood. And it's weaving three incidents together. We are living according to a deadline. That's the only explanation I can find for the crowd that surrounded the victim on the walk outside the restaurant where I worked as a waitress in Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1970. Nervousness passed from face to face, as in the game Telephone we used to play as children, where someone whispered us a secret and we passed it on until the last person in the circle said it and the secret changed. At some point in history, we must have received the original instructions for living, but they are lost now. All the handwritten messages that explained what the years can't tell us have been torn to shreds, all of the explanations as to why the years were out. His blood on the walk, and I remember now that a 2-year-old leaned away from her mother and placed a finger in the red pool near the man's head as if she wanted to know how warm a dead man's blood is. Has nothing to do with my life now, has nothing to do with the way my mind cannot hold its attention on what is directly in front of it. This fall, the redbud I am planting in the front yard, and my own 2-year-old, who has taken the shovel from my hands and is trying to dig, his face turning suddenly serious and persistent as a gray sky. That day, I felt as though I'd walked out of my childhood as out of a burning house, and into my 20th year. I was afraid of the body on the walk, and I wanted to throw something heavy over it, a coat, but the little girl's mother did. All my past fears seemed insignificant. The time my father and I sailed out to a lighthouse in the Chesapeake Bay, across rough water, and I was afraid of the spray which flew in my face, and of my father's laughter which sounded like nails shaken in someone's hands, or the memory of trying to piece together a blue and white china vase I threw in anger against the wall when I was 5, and the sudden fear I felt when the idea struck me, as it struck me again at 20 and now, that the essential shapes of things can all be lost. Thank you.